people are going to want you to stay on their team. So they'll say, hey, Chris, why don't you stay, you know, with me? Alexander, why don't you stay with me? Because you were so great when we were at Pick a Place. Why don't you come work for me at this next place? And it can be tempting. If you really respect that person, you'll want to go do it. But think about what you want to do. Write it down, because your brain is an unreliable computer. And kind of create a plan and stick to it.
Hello, and welcome to the new Mission Career Transition Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Caprellian, and I'm joined by my co-host, sister, and talent management pro, Alexandra Caprellian. We interview service members that transition to new careers, DoD representatives, and civilian HR professionals to provide you with lessons learned you won't get in a transition class and to help you transition with confidence. You're listening to this because you know you're getting ready to get out. Me too. But maybe there's that adventure, that one thing that you really wanted to do. There are a lot of systems and a lot of support mechanisms out there that are going to tell you how to get that job right after you transition, right after you retire. But maybe you should take the time to really think about pursuing that adventure. Maybe it's an adventure with your family. The guest on this next episode, Chris Fott, he's going to tell you what he did. He took the dive. He pulled the trigger and hit the X ring. Him and his family went sailing across the globe for a year after he got out of the military. And he's going to talk about how he did it and also lay out a plan that you might adopt to pursue your adventure after your military service. He'll talk about that. And he'll also talk about his process on coming back to land and what he's doing in the IT sector. So stay tuned. Chris Fott, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how are you? It's great to be here.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah, happy to have you on. It's been a while since we've seen each other at Second Maw, and you've had a kind of a very unique, interesting transition out of the military. We're going to talk about you sailing the seven seas and then transitioning back to land and then doing some interesting things too with technology. But first, before we get into that, I'd like you to tell our listeners and us, where'd you grow up and how did you get into the military? I know you started out enlisted and then went the officer route. So where did it all start?
Yeah. I'm coming up on 30 years exactly from then. So, I was a high school kid, 17 years old, and knew I wanted to fly. It's something I'd always wanted to do. And so I, in my infinite wisdom, walked into just the local recruiting office. I grew up in Redmond, Oregon, which is, if you look at the state, is kind of a square. It's generally right in the middle. So I had to drive to the next town in Bend. And I went in there, and airplanes, Air Force. I go in. I think the guy was at lunch or something. I can't remember. I walk into the Navy. And just wasn't really impressed with that particular guy. So it's kind of serendipitous. And I was on my way out because I didn't know that anybody else had airplanes. And the Marine, who was, looked good in uniform, he's in good shape, et cetera, is like, hey, you know, what's your name, kid? I told him. And he said, well, why don't you come on in here? And so I did, because I didn't have anything better to do that day. And so he starts talking to me about airplanes. He says, oh, I used to fix airplanes. And so he starts showing me all these pictures of OV-10s at the time. And he's showing me a picture of a crashed airplane in the jungle. And he goes, see that? That's an OV-10. I worked on it. And then he pulls out another. These were Polaroids. And I'm nodding my head like, oh, yeah, crashed airplane. And he pulls out another one. And he goes, see that airplane? I worked on that one too. And it still doesn't kind of, the light isn't coming on in my 17-year-old brain yet. And by the third airplane, I'm like, man, this guy, every airplane he works on it has crashed in the jungle. And he was stationed in Okinawa. So anyway, I don't know why that sunk in, but I thought it sounded like a grand adventure, and it certainly wouldn't be me that crashed an airplane. And so he said, hey, kid, this is a sure route to be a pilot. You enlist as a cook. And I'm like, okay, you had me, hello. So anyway, that's what I did, and ended up in the reserves, and never went to cook school. So I ended up as like the pot shack guy. When bulldozers get moved around, you have these guys that run and put the tires in front of them so they don't chew up the parking lot. So I did that. I carried an M60 because it's heavy and nobody likes it. I built myself as a whole transportation technician. You know, it was an engineer battalion, so we had to dig holes and move things and build tents and stuff. So yeah, anything involving like inventorying chainsaws and moving holes and that kind of stuff. So it was really unpleasant, but I learned a lot and it was fun. So fun in a I don't want to repeat it sort of way.
I can imagine.
Yeah,
that's a great salesman technique too. Let's take that back.
But you know, it kind of worked because I ended up accidentally getting into ROTC. I just showed up there and I'd been out of boot camp like 3 days, and a staff sergeant at the time named Doug Lubke sees me with my screaming high and tight and my boot camp tan, and he's like, "Hey, what's your name?" And I told him. And as soon as he goes, "Come here." And I kind of froze and, you know, I start hyperventilating and my heart goes into arrhythmia, and he goes, "What's your name, kid?" And I said, "This recruit's name." And he's like, he goes, "Oh no, here we go. You'd be here at drill tomorrow at 5 a.m. and, go upstairs and have Chief Sadat give you uniforms." And here I am. It never occurred to me to say no, or I don't want to, or, you know, it all kind of played into what I wanted to do anyway. But eventually I got our ROTC scholarship because of a guy named Doug Lukey. And I still keep in contact with him occasionally. But
no kidding. That's pretty cool. You still keep in touch with him. Mm-hmm. So what did you do after you went through your OCS and the basic school? What did you end up doing?
Yeah, so I got... you discharge from the reserves, you know, when you get a scholarship, they change your status and stuff. And I went to kind of typical path that everybody does with OCS and the basic school. And there's a pretty long wait to get down to flight school. I think it's still that way. But I went to another school there in Quantico called Infantry Officer Course, and then went down to kind of join the rest of my beer drinking, water skiing roommates at flight school. And spent the next 2.5 years or so between Camp Pendleton and then Pensacola. You know, I went back and forth for like permissive TAD, and then got my wings and went to the RAG out in Camp Penn to fly the Cobra, and then went to New River and kind of continued from there as a Cobra pilot for the first, I don't know, 10, 15 years.
And then after you were a Cobra pilot, I know everybody gets there, you kind of start your career in the cockpit, but then eventually you transition into becoming staff. What were your staff tours like?
Yeah. So I did one deployment as a Cobra pilot on the East Coast. And then I went over to a rifle battalion and deployed with the Mew. And that was an interesting segue as well. The battalion commander had been my Marine officer instructor, the MOI, when I was in college. So he'd known me since I was 18. And then I was his air officer during OIF-1, and just a tremendous impact on my life. I absolutely love the guy. And that was a wonderful tour and really kept me in the Marine Corps. I was going to get out. It was a very adversarial relationship as a young guy when I was a new pilot. And after that experience at 1-8, had already told the monitor that I would do anything to get out of the East Coast, to include taking a deploying fact tour back to back off of the last Mew that I'd gone on. So he said, "Yeah, and you could go to Camp Pendleton." And I'd been dating this girl; she's now my wife. And I'd asked her to marry me right before we left, and I went on that deployment. And due to her bad judgment, she said yes. So I, you know, came back from that tour, went out to SoCal, and joined another squadron. And finished out there. And then the staff tours I did were pretty minimal. I won 3-year tour at the basic school as an instructor, which was tremendously rewarding and just fantastic. Surrounded by some of the best captains in the Marine Corps, great enlisted staff. And then second lieutenants are just wonderful people. They're super enthusiastic. They're funny. There's always somebody who's a singer or an artist or whatever. So you have all these skills across 250 people, and yeah, they make mistakes, but so does everybody else. And you're there to teach anyway, but it was just wonderful. And so 3 years there and then back to the fleet. And I really didn't have a job that didn't require hearing protection until I was after the Naval War College. I went to Tampa and was a staff officer down at U.S. Central Command for 2 years.
Okay.
And then I came back to Second Mon and was on the staff there.
Out of all the tours that you've done, was there one that made the biggest imprint on you and maybe had the greatest influence on what you did after getting out of the military, after retiring from the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I would separate those probably into two areas. The biggest influence was probably just as a man was the basic school as an instructor. And I just had the good fortune to work for just phenomenal people, both at the kind of intermediate level. The, you know, I was a major, so the lieutenant colonels that were around, you know, there was not one of them that wasn't just stellar. I really, really enjoyed it. And I just got super lucky. Mm. And then the CO at the time was George Smith Jr. And he was just a fantastic guy. And I still keep in touch with him. And I just really, really can't say enough positive things about that guy. And so I just, you know, formatively and teaching him, you know, about leadership and how you treat people and that kind of stuff, I, again, lucked out. In terms of, you know, learning stuff that I could take into a professional application after the Marine Corps, it was really as my, I went back and joined a VMU squadron, an unmanned, like as a drone squadron. You know, when I was done flying off of my last deployment. And I just learned a tremendous amount, both about psychology, about the adoption of new things, about resistance to change, and then a bunch of tech stuff, you know, data links and networks and different classification enclaves and, you know, a bunch of nerd stuff that everybody would immediately start, you know, snoring if I went into details on. But, you know, basically the massive opportunity in a new technology and all the kind of resistance to that change that I encountered inside of my own service. And I knew at that point that I had to go, but not anything negative. I just kind of an observation at that point, but it served me well since then.
You were the commander of a squadron that was pretty much employing a new capability then and probably seemed to be, I think you've, to quote you from a previous conversation, you felt like you were potentially excommunicated from a church because it was so new and it was now it's kind of drones. I know, what was it VMU was flying at the time?
Yeah, it's VMU too. But yeah, it's a good analog, you know, and I've heard the black sheep or just being excommunicated, but Marine aviation is very insular. And this is just me, you know, as a retired guy talking, you know, and it may be a little bit different now, but anything that was different, if it doesn't fit inside of the norm, like, hey, we have these programs, here's how we, you know, bring a new capability, a new airplane, new pick a thing. It's very insular and very personality based, and everybody knows everybody. And so it's this little, almost like a church, and you can't deviate from kind of what the accepted dogma is, or you're a heretic, you know, you're kind of dismissed. And I don't mean that in a, they kick you out of the Marine Corps way. It's just that your opinion is no longer valued and you're not really on the football team, and you can sense it, you know, it's quite obvious, when you realize what is happening. And so you just kind of continue. I mean, the truth is still the truth, and, you know, facts, smile, send people Christmas cards, you know, the normal stuff that ensures that you have a welcome audience when you're talking to people that may disagree with you. But it really kind of cemented things for me when I knew that all around you, you know, the rest of the planet, every other conflict around the world, other air forces were adopting this, you know, and the Marine Corps, who was, you know, a trendsetter, one of the earliest to adopt this technology in the 80s, was way, way late. And, you know, VMU one, there's still no Marine maintainers that fix a big wing UAV, the Reaper. And we just made the first few Reaper pilots in the last, 2 years. And that thing's been flying for 20.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, it was, you know, no bad blood or anything. It just kind of a diagnosis on my end going, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to go do something else. Yeah. Which I'm glad it worked out great.
That's great. Is that the segue though? I was going to ask you, at what point in time did you make the mental commitment to transition? I don't know if it had to do with your time and how you saw things were changing, but maybe not changing enough. Maybe you could describe that for us. At what point in time did decide you were going to mentally decide to transition out of the military or retire?
Yeah. I think for me, it's always been, can you make an effective contribution, and are you still on the team? You know, and are you still one of those valued key players? And when I knew that I really wasn't, and then I kind of looked around and looked up and said, well, is there anything in the future that I would really like to do that involves wearing this uniform where I could still continue to row, you know, and be part of the team and like make an effective contribution in a way that was meaningful, not just, you know, as a spoke in the massive wheel. And I kind of looked around and I just couldn't see that. You know, I couldn't see a way up. You know, I look up and go, well, could you be a group commander? No, you're a robot guy. Okay, well, what about a MU commander? No. Well, what can you be? Well, you could go to Aviation Hallway. Well, I don't like DC and I don't like the Pentagon and I don't want to do that. And so it was this like, well, what about this? What about this? And it was like, no, that's not for you. You know, we have, go drink out of that drinking fountain, you over there with the nerds. And so I just kind of knew that I had, my days were numbered and I just wasn't really sure how that would go. And so I talked to a lot of mentors and made a decision to continue and go to school, which if you forecast that out, it's like, you know, if you go to top level school, then okay, that's a year at school plus a 2-year commitment thereafter. But if you don't really look at, you know, playing chess, not checkers, you get to that 2-year point and you're in receipt of orders. And so then you got to go again, which incurs another 2 years. Then you're on a colonel's board, which incurs 3. And pretty soon you're in this trap and you go, wait a minute, you guys said 2, but it's 6. It's 6 years, you know? Mm. And then you go, okay, now my kids, I'm moving them again in high school. And I realized when I kind of put all that together while I was at Newport at school and realized, oh, this is how this is going to work. And so I went back down to Tampa and worked for George Smith again. And then I knew then that you got to make an exit plan. And so I just started very unequivocally planning out what are the must do's and must not do's, and built them out in an Excel spreadsheet and just kind of went from there. So it was kind of an iterative process, but there's more to it than just getting out, because you had to, if I knew I was going to get on a sailboat, and that's, I thought, well, if I can't do this thing and be part of the team, I want to go do this other thing that I've always wanted to do. And I looked around, I thought, okay, my kids are at this age. I won't be able to do it. They're going to be in college or dad's not cool or whatever. And so I thought, well, I got to do this now. And so I just started really constraining my spending. I started investing a lot more. You know, and it became this flywheel effect. You know, I bought a 1999 Honda Accord for $1,000. It's great to have a car whose value changes by 10% based on the gas gauge. but I bought this thing and it's such a heat, man. The paint is coming off. One time the bumper fell off it in a parking lot and I put it back on with zip ties, and the zip ties are still there holding it on. And so this thing is just a jalopy. But every time I stick the key in the ignition, it goes. And it gets 33 miles per gallon and it's hideous and it's got a tape deck and I love it. And that car, by my math, is worth about $200,000. If you look at what the cost avoidance was in terms of interest and payments and all the other stuff on a new car, and then you invest that difference and look at what over that 10-year period that investment has produced, it turned into a year on a sailing catamaran with my family, you know, and that's a simplification, but it's not far off the mark.
Isn't that crazy? Cost avoidance of buying $1,000 car.
$1,000.
$1,000. Old. It was a cost avoidance of $200K over a 10-year period.
Yep.
That is mind blowing.
And the real crazy in all this is if you're 22 years old, an F-150 is probably about $1 million. You know, in the time value of money by the time you're 65. If you're 62, an F-150 is $50,000, you know?
Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
I want that spreadsheet. You still got that thing? Send that to me. I want to do that. It's probably going to tell me to buy something I don't want to buy, but you know.
It'll say, you know, get a bike. Walk, man. Get control your expenses.
I bet you in the cost avoidance, it's probably cheaper to get a bike because then I'd wear out too many shoes over a 10-year period. But we'll save that for a different spreadsheet. What I want to know is where did you get the idea of, after you retire, just sail the family in a boat for a year? How did that come up?
Yeah, I'd always, the Marine Corps next to the ocean, and I'd always enjoyed it. And I built a boat. I've always owned a boat. And so we'd go fishing on the weekend and I was always on the water. And I knew that I loved sailing, and I took a class when I was a captain at Camp Pendleton and got certified and all that stuff. And when I was, spent about 2.5 years of my life at sea with the Navy, fortunately or unfortunately. But the first, 4 or 5 months, I hated it. It was terrible. It's a floating prison. Mm. Plus there's a guy that blows a whistle every 15 minutes to tell you it's a different time, as if you don't own a watch, to include it might be chow, or it's prayer time, or it's get up time, or whatever. This the whistle guy. But on your own boat, you don't have any of that. So I just learned to really enjoy a lot of being at sea. I saw these things, and when you take off from the ship, you could see whale sharks. I would see big pods of whales. I'd see all kinds of things, while you're out flying around. And it just became this enormous curiosity and sense of personal responsibility that there's no one there to save you. It's just you. No one will tell you what to do. No one will tell you, what you can't do. And there's just this one judge. It's the ocean. And if you screw it up, the consequences are stark and immediate. And so I took my lovely bride out sailing one time. We got about 1 mile out the inlet at Oceanside. And she looks at me when she was super bored, and she goes, can we start the engine? And I was heartbroken. And so I motor sailed up to Dana Point. I just remember just thinking, oh, my dreams are shattered, And I was like, young captain. And, so we spent the night up there, and I sailed back under the spinnaker, and it was this beautiful SoCal day. It's about 80 and sunny, light breeze, and this spinnaker, that big sail that you see in, when you walk into the dentist office and there's a sailboat, it's got a spinnaker up. Mm. And so we're just, in a group of about 5 other boats coming back into Oceanside, and I could tell she loved it. And that was kind of it for a little while until we got up to Newport. And in Rhode Island, there's this all women's sailing club thing. And no matter what I did to teach her, it was bad and wrong because I'm her husband. But she had this epiphany with a bunch of other women, and she came home one night, and she goes, oh, I was on the sailing team. We're out in the harbor and J-22s, and here's how you attack. And I'm nodding my head going, yeah, I love that. Everything you said was wonderful. And she goes, well, I'm going back on Friday. And I said, okay, that's great. You do that. And so she liked it. And I think that really opened her mind to being able to do it. So when we're in Tampa and I said, hey, we could do this. We'd have to get rid of everything. And then there's this negotiating back and forth on, well, what does everything mean? What about my flower pots? Well, yeah, your flower pots. Well, what about that piece of furniture that I really like? And you're like, I don't know. We'll get another one. And if that's the wrong answer, then okay, fine. Storage unit,
Yeah.
So anyway, it was like a 2-year process to get through the 12 steps of grief or whatever to get rid of all that stuff. But right now we're working, going back to North Carolina to get all of it and drag it back across the country. There's like, I don't know, a half of a room full of stuff that she couldn't part with. So anyway.
Okay. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, I'm an E8 or an E9, I'm an 04 or an 05, 06, and you've just planted the seed. And I'm wondering, could I do this? Is this something that I could do? What would be the advice that you'd give on how to plan and execute that, knowing, and then certainly you have to get into the, how do you convince the team, the family,
right,
to not kill each other.
Killing each other comes later, Chris.
Yeah. Yeah, but lay that on us. Like, how do you, what would we do?
It's a good one. So the first step is the convincing. I think there's an element of fear. If you're unfamiliar, and my wife was unfamiliar, my boys, it was a they were oblivious and just didn't care. And so, you know, like, hey, you want to get on a boat? Yeah, sure. You know, it was easy. So convincing your other half to get on a boat is, you know, you can't force it, and it's got to be something that, and it should be something that's, you know, joyful, but there's no way to get around that it's super stressful. And so you got all the things that people tend to come up with like, well, what about pirates? What if I die? What about the Kraken? You know, tsunamis, you know, Columbus, or who was, what was it, Robert Redford, where he's talking to himself on the boat? And, you know, they see that movie and think, oh my God, you know, we're all going to starve. We'll have to resort to cannibalism. Which one of you do I eat first? And all those things are kind of natural, and they're loony, right? So bad stuff that happens to you on a boat is typically lightning, which happens at a dock. It can happen at sea, but most of the time it's at a dock. And stuff that happens when you're anchored. You know, the wind blows really hard, your anchor drags, you're on the rocks, and no more boat. And there's a whole bunch of other things that can go wrong, but statistically, most of the things that go wrong are at the edge of the water, kind of like an airplane. Nothing happens bad in the middle of the air. It's the edge of the air. That's where everything bad happens, you know, like a mountain or space, or you crash into the ground. That's all bad, right?
Yeah.
But if you stay right in the middle of the air, you're good. And a boat's the same way. So I think that that kind of coming to grips with fear is the first stage. And the second one is, well, we don't, who are you, Ferdinand Magellan? You don't know how to do this. No, but neither did Magellan. He went and learned. And it's not rocket science. You know, you can figure out how to do it. And what I would say is that all the internet advice wasn't all that useful, because they say, well, go rent boats and go volunteer as a crew on a race boat. And, you know, if you're an active duty, you know, soldier, sailor, airman, marine, you typically don't have time to do that, you know? Or if you have a little bit of leave, like, when do you actually use 3 weeks of leave? Well, when in the middle of a PCS. So you're moving household goods, you're trying to find a house, kids school. I mean, it's a yard sale. Mm. So in reality, there's short-term rentals who typically won't rent to you if you don't have experience. But you can get, like, start with little boats. I bought a Hobie Cat in St. Petersburg when we were in Tampa Bay. Family loved it. You know, you're flying a haul out in Tampa Bay. It was, I don't know, $1,500 on Craigslist or something. And the second thing that's really important, you know, if you really want to do it, you'll figure it out and study and find resources, or just call me. We'll talk. And the second one is money. You know, very few things on this earth can vaporize money as fast as a boat, maybe a helicopter, you know? But like, you could have a bigger Coke habit than Charlie Sheen and probably still not blow as much money as if you owned a boat. So you need some money to do this.
So plenty of opportunity to buy, lose, vice buy, win. So
yeah. And there's no like, well, I'll buy a cheap boat. There's no such thing. The only cheap boat is a smaller boat. And for us, we had two kids and wanted to stay married. So we went with a catamaran, and I loved it. It's a great boat. But you can get a lot cheaper with a monohull. It's just a lot more cramped, and it's deeper draft. So there's some places you can't go. But if you really want to go, find a boat that works. There's no such thing as a perfect boat, and go.
What did you learn from that experience? Like, were there the major takeaways?
There was some stuff that's, I think, mental health things. So depending on what you did for a living in the military, you may or may not have snakes and spiders or stuff that you struggle with as you get a little bit older, or that you may suppress inside of a bottle, or various other unhealthy ways of dealing with it. I think that you really got to be honest with yourself and think, okay, am I a special snowflake or unique, or am I susceptible to these things too? And the answer obviously is yeah, you know, unless you, if you legitimately just, hey, I wasn't exposed to anything like that, or I don't carry any baggage that, you know, I don't wake up at night thinking about stuff, then don't sweat it. But if you do, then you should find healthy ways to deal with that. And you probably, while you're on active duty, don't have a deliberate way of decompressing and dealing with that in a, I guess, specific, you know, healthy manner. Mm. Most people don't. And so for me, that was really useful to be out on the boat and just master of your own destiny. And if you want to get up at 4 a.m., you get up at 4 a.m. If you want to get up at 2 p.m., you get up at 2 p.m. And a lot of the focus on something entirely different really helped. But it was an enormous stressor. But there's a lot of times down in the Bahamas where it's just me and my family. And, you know, I was kiteboarding with my boys. And it was just really, really valuable. And I think if you get out of the military and immediately transition into some 60-hour-a-week job, you know, there's health ramifications for that and relationship ramifications for that. And when I say health, I mean mental and physical health. And if you kind of look around, you've got, everybody has people who are a generation or two in front of them. You know, I'd call a generation in the military like 5 to 7 years. And you look at some of these folks and heart problems, back problems, death, suicide. And there's just a lot of things that kind of build up and you think, I don't want to do that. And I don't want to end up where that guy ended up. And I don't want to stick a pistol in my mouth and I don't want cancer and I don't want to, you know, all these really terrible things. And so, I just thought, hey, I need to make sure that I do some preventative maintenance here. And so I thought that was really important. And that's one of the things that I got the most out of. And I think the next one was, you know, I got pretty good at holding my breath and stalking grouper and lobster.
Yum.
Yeah. So, yeah, you said yum, but at one point I remember climbing back onto the boat with dinner, you know, and I'm all wet and throwing, you know, pole spears and stuff back onto the transom. And my youngest boy, who was 12 at the time, walks back out while his brother and I are getting out of the dinghy. And I throw a grouper and a lobster up on the boat. And he goes, "Oh, Dad, do we have to have grouper again?" And I'm like, "Kid, nobody on earth, those words don't come out of normal people's mouth." But yes, you tortured soul, you're going to have grouper again.
At least you didn't say lobster. Oh, man, yeah, can we have lobster again?
Yeah, lobster mac and cheese, lobster stuffed grouper, grouper stuffed lobster, you name it.
Well, I think that's a great counter narrative. I mean, and I'm glad you brought it up because I'm not going to hate on it because I think it's great, but we've had guests come on and talk about the Skill Bridge program and how you can use your, you know, the leave that you have saved up at the end of your enlistment or during, you know, if you're getting ready to retire, you know, just before you retire plus transition PTAD, that you can go to work right away for a company and potentially get employed by them. And I think that's pretty good if that's a great thing if it works for you. But I think you also bring up the alternative, right? Maybe for some people, it's a good idea to not go from 80 miles an hour or 100 miles an hour into something that's at the same speed, the same pace, in a different location for a large corporation if you haven't had that break, if you haven't had that, if you need the mental space and maybe some investment in oneself. So I think that's kind of interesting. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I've got a close personal friend that he didn't do SkillBridge, but he went straight into Amazon and, you know, he's running warehouses and logistics and, you know, on his feet at times for 16 hours a day. Like as they get close to Christmas and stuff, it is, it's tough, you know, and they've got a mission as well. And so when I think about that, you know, his kids were a little older, he's prepping for college, et cetera. And he just wanted stability over everything else for his family. And so he, in his mind is saying, okay, you know, what my desires and requires are irrelevant. I need to make it right for everybody around me and for my family. And I get it. That makes a lot of sense. If you have the luxury, though, to not do that, and it's something that you need, do it. And all that stuff isn't going to matter if your health suffers significantly, or you know, if you're struggling with other things. You know, if you've got mental health issues or alcoholism or any of those other things that you know are going to be problematic, then you got to deliberately go out and do something about it, so that you don't end up, if you're looking ahead of you at that next generation and say, well, this guy that I really respect, or this other guy, or a friend or whatever, and you watch them go through it and you think, I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want that to happen to me. Then I think you need to make a plan that's very specific to avoid that.
That makes a lot of sense. So what brought you back to land? Like how long were you sailing, and then what brought you back and searching for a new utensil set?
Yeah, Chris. Well, let me tell you about boat yoga. So every night in your boat, there's the boat ferry, and the boat ferry strikes, and you don't know what she broke, but she like flits around down in the bilge, casting spells on a bilge pump or burning out a wire or your water maker or something. And it's broken. You just don't know it. Now the bilge hermit battles the boat ferry. And so it's like the force of good versus the force of evil. And my boys came up with this because I would appear out of the transom. You know, I'm down inside of, imagine this super tight engine compartment filled with like gooey salt water and mixed with oil, because you clean it and stuff, but it doesn't matter. It's a bilge. And then my kids would go down there like, dad's swearing. And I'm like trying to fix a pump or whatever broke that day. So if the bilge hermit is down there doing boat yoga because you're laying across a hot engine trying to get, you know, a pump to work again, or, you know, some screwdriver that you dropped or whatever, that's a lot of what sailing is. Or as a guy smarter than me once said, it's doing boat maintenance in exotic places. And so I did a full month of that up in the Chesapeake and another full month of that in Guatemala. And at one point I thought, this stinks. I'm in Central America. There's bugs. I'm just gushing sweat, you know? So you're doing diesel maintenance shirtless, just completely soaked in sweat down in a bilge wearing a headlamp. So that portion of it was pretty unpleasant. And I drug my family through that because you got to have help. And so that was a little bit of a downer. The rest of it was enormously positive other than Jamaica. And, I kind of was in the middle of that unpleasant process. And I thought, you know, my oldest son, you know, we're doing school online and all this other stuff, trying to kind of do homeschool, boat school. And he would ask me questions about, you know, math, or I'm grading his algebra homework. And I'm like, what's the quadratic function 4AC? You know, and I'm like, Khan Academy. He's like, yeah, I tried that, but we don't have internet. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm really starting to impact this kid's ability. He says he wants to be an engineer and like he can't get the education that he needs. And my youngest was still at a place where I could do it. I could teach him. And my wife was teaching everything from anatomy and physiology to biology to you name the ology. And I was, you know, doing the, you know, give me a one pager on the legislative branch and that kind of stuff. But ultimately when he's like, you know, dad, I can't draw this quadratic equation. And I thought, well, you came to the wrong place, man, because I can't either. I thought we should reconsider this. And I thought what we were planning on doing was I had to get the boat out of the water for hurricane season. So like 5 months or so. And we're just going to get some backpacks, go to Peru and do these ecotourism kind of deals where you volunteer and you work at a, you know, chinchilla ranch or something. And, and then they pay for your room and board, and then you hike to the next place. And I thought, I could do that. You know, I'd live out of a rucksack before. This will be fun. And family was all in. Wife, amazingly, was like, yep, that sounds great. Let's do it. Because she wanted to go down and see Machu Picchu. And then my mom came down to visit, and they said, well, hey, we're doing this remodel job up in Oregon. You want to come up here? And I was like, yeah, sure. And when I got here, I thought, hey, this, I could just off-ramp right here and sell the boat and put the kids in school. And so we did. And I ended up moving from a boat into an RV. So I lived in an RV for like 8 or 9 months. We just closed on this house about a month ago. So,
oh, wow.
out of one mobile, not quite house into a different mobile, not quite house, but
and it sounds
decided to leave. Yeah.
It sounds amazing.
Yeah. Like
talk about, I mean, talk about a breach from the norm and just living an adventure with, you know, a couple months of doing now forever fixed in my mind boat yoga. we need to copyright that term. So trolling your LinkedIn profile, and I'm sure maybe others will too. How did you end up becoming a chief product officer for Sapient One? And what does Sapient One do?
So Sapient One is a like technology integration company and does a lot of defense oriented work in augmented reality and virtual reality space, in addition to some other very specific work inside of DoD and the intelligence community. I was, again, in the trailer thinking, you know, I should go get a couple of mountain bikes, you know, because I might be here for a couple more than 1 or 2 months. And, you know, I'm surrounded by great mountains and stuff. And I called a friend of mine who was actually the squadron commander before me. And so I'd worked for him for 6 months. And I always call him about every 6 months or so. I called him and said, hey, how you doing? And he goes, oh, I'm doing good. What are you doing? And I told him, and he goes, huh, so you think you're going to stay in Oregon? I said, I don't know. We're thinking about it. And he goes, well, why don't I send you a job offer? And I go, for doing what? And he goes, it's augmented reality. And I go, I can't even spell augmented reality. And he goes, no, I think you'll be okay. And so it was just serendipitous. And it was a guy that was a friend of mine that I'd known, you know, for quite some time. And he had a startup that has numerous verticals. This is one of them. And he goes, I need you to take this project and run it to ground. So he made me an offer and it worked. And I thought, you know, again, controlling your expenses is kind of the theme. My burn rate was sized to live off of some savings and my retirement. And we'd really controlled a lot of that. And even with quite a bit of boat expense, I hadn't really touched much of anything. We still bought what I wanted to buy and things like that. But for instance, if you want lunch in Guatemala, the Coca-Cola costs more than the tacos. So it just doesn't cost a lot. And he said, here, do you want this job? And I took it. And then on the first paycheck, I just went and bought some mountain bikes. And second one, I went and bought some dirt bikes and off to the races.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, what does a chief product officer do?
We outsource a lot of our software development to other shops because, frankly, we're a pretty small business and can't afford to hire the developers in a way that I could pretty much guarantee that we wouldn't lay them off. You know, if the job, you know, if that individual job failed, I never want to be in a position where I have to lay somebody off. So we outsource while we grow until I can onboard people with a degree of security. So I do a lot of customer facing interaction with, you know, our client on the augmented reality front. And then I come back to the software development guys and say, I want it to be, you know, hey, we're having object recognition issues with the LiDAR, or, you know, the visual representation isn't quite right in iOS or Android or whatever. And so a lot of that competency was based on stuff I'd learned working in UAV land, and the rest of it stuff I've had to pick up on the fly. And then the other stuff was the DoD and IC type of work is very similar to stuff I did related to the force design initiatives inside the Marine Corps. So it was a pretty easy jump into that. And anything you don't know, you write it down and go Google it.
I can't wait to hear your thoughts about this whole AI, chat, GPT, whatever they call it now. It's scary to me, but...
Oh, it's awesome. I used it the other day.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It is a crazy system that's coming out. I'm just waiting for that one day where they just the system tells us that it hates us. I don't know. I have no idea. But real quick, I mean, just from you mentioning what you're currently doing now, and that it was kind of an easy transition because it was something recognizable to what you were doing in the Marine Corps, or at least something you knew you can jump into. Was it a shock to the system from, you know, having the freedom of doing what you wanted and being with your family and then going straight into this work again? What was that like?
It was actually pretty straightforward. While a boat doesn't have structure, it does have mandates. You know, you can't, like, I would have to be at home at noon, turn on the freezer, manage the solar, check all the battery levels, inverter. I was constantly obsessed with the weather. I didn't get a good night's sleep year because your house can move and does, and then people anchor next to your house and can screw up. So I would wake up several times a night and I'd be outside looking around. So you're never really, especially if you're in charge, you know, that if the health and safety of your family is on you, you know, period dot, then you're just always kind of on edge. And when you leave your boat, like, hey, I'm going to go ashore and get groceries, that's a 7-hour project. And so there's a level of stress, and I'm not saying it's, you know, it's not like it's going to give you a arrhythmia, but it's not this idyllic Jimmy Buffett kind of context all the time. And so when I transitioned and got to this job, I, you know, a little bit of structure, but I mean, let's face it, I work in my house, I'm on the internet. I'm wearing shorts and flip flops right now and a collared shirt, so I look like I kind of got up this morning, but I could go to the YMCA. I lifted weights with my boys this morning, took them to school. I mean, it's great.
Business on top, party down below, and still getting your lift on when you need it.
It's the mullet life.
Nice. Well, a lot of great information about, you know, first going to sail the seven seas and then going into tech. If there were a few points or a few tips you wanted to provide our listeners, things you don't want them to forget as they prepare for their own transition, what would they be?
Number one is there's an inherent degree of maybe not fear, but trepidation, you know, especially if you think, okay, I'm the breadwinner. I got to make sure people go to college and the lights come on when they hit the switch and everybody gets food. And so there's this degree of stress to go, I can't, you know, be screwing around. Don't worry about it. You'll be okay. You know, if you've done the types of qualities that made you pretty good at what you did inside of the military, you know, hard work and all that other stuff, they'll serve you well if you go network and talk to the people that you already know and have an open mind and smile. You know, you'd be surprised what good playground skills can do. And two is, be careful of military mentorship. By definition, when you're talking to somebody in uniform, they've never gotten out of the military before, right? So you're saying, hey, you know, Colonel, General, Sergeant Major, so-and-so, what do you think? And they're going to say, oh, you should definitely stay in because of this, that, and the other. And they're not being disingenuous. They're saying that because they like you. And it's a normal human response. But it may not be what's right for you, right? So that who you ask, the mentor you choose, will dictate the answer that you get. And oftentimes, if you're a pretty good egg, people are going to want you to stay on their team. So they'll say, hey, Chris, why don't you stay, you know, with me? Alexander, why don't you stay with me? Because you were so great when we were at Pick a Place. Why don't you come work for me at this next place? And it can be tempting. If you really respect that person, you'll want to go do it. But think about what you want to do. Write it down, because your brain is an unreliable computer, and kind of create a plan and stick to it. And I'm overjoyed that I made the decision to get out of the Marine Corps, and I have no ill will. It was a wonderful place to grow up, but it was not a good place to be grown up. And I'm glad I made the decision I did. I haven't regretted it for one second. And then last thing, get your financial house in order. If you're living, you know, at your means, try to get below it. If you've got a lot of debt, start restricting your spending and get rid of it. And I think a lot of people equate that to making a bunch of life sacrifices, but I didn't make that at all. You know, I just looked at things that were not essential. You know, don't buy a huge house. And what most people spend the most money on is cars, and they just suck you dry. And if you kind of downsize those expenses, you'll be amazed. The first year, debt starts to go down. Second year, the debt's gone. Third year, you've got some savings. And it just keeps going until pretty soon you're looking at a savings account. And I don't mean like a retirement account, but something where you could really go do something you've always wanted to do. And you think, hey, that's probably going to cost us, you know, $150,000, $250,000. You'll have it. It sounds huge, but it's really not that huge. It's the time, not the money. And that's it. Those are the things I would say.
All great takeaways, including the last one, which, if you have your financial house in order, you're not subject to golden handcuffs.
That's right.
Yeah. You can do what you want to do. You can do which hopefully is also the same thing that's great for your family if you have one. So, no, all sound advice. Really appreciate it. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I really enjoyed talking about a very unique transition story, but it also gives hope to others, even if it's not sailing. Maybe somebody has a big adventure that they want to do, they want to do with their family, and take advantage of the time that they still have while they're healthy, and maybe their families of the right dynamics to actually go execute that adventure with. So thanks. Thank you so much for your time, Chris. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right. I'll be in touch.
Okay. Thanks.
Chris Fott has left the digital studio and I now want to be a pirate sailing the seven seas. My vision's bad enough. I probably don't need an eye patch.
Yeah, I was thinking, what theme song could we play in the background? Is it like a Pirates of the Caribbean situation? You know, I have no idea. He did mention one thing. He mentioned Polaroids. Now, for all the young listeners out there, a Polaroid... No, I'm just kidding. But honestly, you might have to Google it.
Well, they still have some Polaroid cameras. Hey, oh, by the way, listeners, I messed up. I ask every guest, how can you get in touch with them? And I forgot to ask that. So... Chris wanted me to relay that you can get in touch with him on LinkedIn. You can find him. His first name is spelled K-R-I-S. Last name is F-A-U-G-H-T. I'll put the URL in the episode notes. If you're on LinkedIn and you follow me or you follow Sis, we'll reshare it. But he's always open to conversation. If you want to bounce ideas off of him, just shoot him a message on LinkedIn. Now that I've got that out of the way, what are your thoughts?
Well, there were two major things that really popped out. We never really have talked about what a transition can actually be, and it doesn't mean going from one thing to the next. It could actually also mean transitioning into just finding what you want and taking the time and finding yourself and what makes the most sense for you. So it's not imperative to find a job right when you leave the military. Doesn't need to happen that way. And he is the true example of taking the time and being with his family. If you have a family, do it if you can, you know. I think that's really important and something that, you know, people haven't really shared. So it was really good to hear. And the other thing that he said is something along the lines of, you know, listen to the opportunities that come your way, but don't necessarily feel like you have to take them or you have to be interested or you owe that person who's coming to you with that possible opportunity anything, really. It's really great to listen to them all the time and to take it in and to do your research, but don't feel like you need to go in that direction.
Yeah, agreed on all points. There were a couple of things that I took away that were slightly different. His emphasis on getting your financial house in order and the cost avoidance analysis on cars. Particularly with the gas prices the way they are. I mean, you know, that savings could be more or less depending upon which state you're living in and what the average cost per gallon is. The other thing was his litmus test for whether or not he should stay in or retire. And it was, do I still contribute? Am I still rowing? And am I still on the team? And I think those are very valid points because it, you know, we because of Title 10 requirements, we are joined to services that have an up or out system. So every branch of service has a different system, but you know, if you don't hit a wicket, you know, maybe don't hit two wickets, you can keep going. That's an individual choice, but I think he had a very pragmatic approach to it. And I think some of that was, you know, like he said, there was a divergence between the things that he thought would be best and the things that maybe were being pursued within certain communities. And he knew it was his time to go. So good alternative perspective on a litmus test. So this wraps up another great conversation. And if you're still listening to us, Jack or Jaw, Bob or Gums, or whatever they're saying in recruit training or boot camp now, thank you very much for listening. We appreciate you and your followership. And if you want to give us feedback, we're all about it. The best way to give us feedback is a 5-star review. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. You'd be helping us out a lot by beating the algorithms and sharing the gouge. You can find us on every major podcast app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, whatever it is you're listening to via this medium. It probably has a star system. Go to the max or give us whatever you think, but we definitely use that as feedback. You can also follow us on Instagram at New Mission CT. That's New Mission Charlie Tango. You could send us a DM for feedback on Instagram, or you could email us at newmissionct@gmail.com. We promise we will get back to you as soon as we can. If you are preparing for your own transition, know that I'm right there with you.
So until next time, stay focused.